This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
She was a vampire who could never see the light of day.
He was a zombie shuffling his way through the afterlife.
Love would bring them together,
but human flesh would tear them apart.
Doomed to be on Sci-Fi and Scream.
Tuesday nights from 10 on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Of course, now, the good, the bad, and the just plain hideous, or are they stinkers? What makes a movie a cult classic, or what makes it just plain and simply terrible? What is the difference? How can we help tonight on the show with our opinions about what we think is good taste, bad taste, gore, fright, and failure? Are they all that bad, or are they significant celluloid idiosyncrasies deserving a lot of time and respect? I think there are some in there. Now, tonight we are full to the brim with guests. There is, of course, Tara Judo is here from The Aster. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
To help out with the cult business we're going to talk about in films. We've also got Zoe Mayer. Did I get that right, Zoe?
You did, Zoe.
Oh, boy. Having troubles there. And Emma's here again.
Again.
Yes, from Generation Next.
Sure am.
That's her other job.
It's my other job.
And Mitch is here as well.
Again.
And Mitch's other show is on Thursdays.
Thursday nights at 7, The Asian Pop Experiment.
Cool. So quite a busy evening we've had already, because before the show here at Joy 94.9, we were lucky enough to go to one of the previews for a film we're going to talk about a bit later on in the show, and that is Dark Shadows, Tim Burton. Does it cut the mustard? We'll find out with our own opinions a bit later. But before that, we're going to start looking at cult films, and that's why we've got Tara in the house for that. Willy Wonka we had on just a minute ago. Now I want to know why Mitch chose that one.
Because it's a classic cult film.
And the name of the song?
Pure Imagination.
Ah, yeah.
And also, like, we had a couple of people already message in and say their favourite cult film, and that was Kiara's favourite cult film, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Kiara from Carlton.
So was that the musical, or are we talking about the Tim Burton one?
Tim Burton.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Scary. Right. Enough of that. Okay, I'm a bit exhausted already.
Yeah, well, I guess we can always mention some of the films we're going to talk about tonight because it's cult night. Yeah. So some that we were thinking about earlier on, because it's difficult to classify a cult film, but just going on our own personal classification, Eraserhead, Repo Man, Frankenhooker and Donnie Darko are some of the things that we're going to be talking about. They all deserve their cult status for different reasons, I think. I don't know about you guys, but my favourite cult film is Frankenhooker. I have a weird...
It's a great film.
It is a great film, and I have this soft spot for sort of the grindhouse and the exploitation films like that. I don't know why, because I think it's probably really weird, but I loved it.
Cool. Now, cult movies are defined by some people as films that are not the typical Hollywood product. Tara?
Well, it's difficult to define a cult film. I think as a starting point, that's a good place to be. Definitely the way in which we discuss something is always against the way we discuss something else. So in terms of mainstream cinema, anything that's considered counterculture or counter cinema would definitely have to be something that has tropes, modes, values, and aesthetics that are inherently different to that, which is one of the things that I think posits some of these films as cult. But it's a little bit deeper than that, and I think that the meanings change. There's a distinction, too, between a film that would be considered a cult film and a film that has gleaned a cult following. So something like Back to the Future is a film that has a cult following. It's a very popular film these days, but it wouldn't classify necessarily as a cult film. So that's an important distinction as well, I think. With cult films, generally, it tends to be partially due to the aesthetics. And a lot of times that comes from the fact that the intent behind these films is often really genuine and really sincere, but perhaps the budget for the films or the way in which the aesthetics came together because of some of those concerns isn't necessarily to a certain standard. And that often we have things like paracinema and B-movies that fit into that category of cult film. But there's also a different type that is a little bit more on the artistic side, which I think where things like El Topo and Holy Mountain sit. And they come out of the fact that they've got something perhaps a little bit surreal or a little bit alternate in, and abstract in the way that they're put together. A lot of the times that's to do with narrative, but it's also, again, back to the visual style. And the final thing really that I think makes a cult film is to do with the transgression. And again, that comes back to that first point about counterculture and something that is outside of the mainstream. And it really has to be something that's a little bit subversive. And certainly socially, that's where cult film started very much, I think, in the early days.
I think another thing as well for me, because I know it's a really personal thing, it's really difficult to define, but the ones that don't follow a straight linear narrative as well is what I always think as being sort of a more occult film, more likely to achieve a good following as well. So both.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those things definitely certainly ask their audience to do a lot of the work. You have a film that doesn't have a linear narrative, and that means that perhaps it's jumping around with certain abstractions, and a lot of David Lynch's films fit into that category. Certainly things like Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive. And it means that the audience has to put in a lot of the work. And that in itself is a subversion against Hollywood, against what we would might call first cinema. And certainly the things that the studios put out there for us.
Well, especially something like David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. The whole thing is about anti-Hollywood.
Absolutely. You know? It's a beautiful example of it. That and Inland Empire too.
Ah, yes. Inland Empire, that's a heavy-duty one indeed. Now, if you have an opinion about cult films and you have a favourite and you haven't seen our Facebook site yet, which we'll be asking you those things too, you can always SMS us.
You should definitely check out our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/sci-fi-and-scream. So we're easy to find.
Yeah.
Difficult to forget.
What has Mitch got to say about that?
Also tonight we've got Zoe. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about tonight?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about my show Goodbye Csirac, Csirac being Australia's first computer.
Ah, and so I've heard about this. I'm really excited. And later we'll be talking to you about what's going to be happening, where it is, what it is. And it's a ghost computer exhibition, isn't it? Or
it's an audio tour and performance at the Melbourne Museum. Ah. And it gets interrupted by the ghost of computers past.
Oh, that sounds really exciting.
Is Alan Turing turning up?
Just me in a shiny jumpsuit, I'm afraid.
All right. No, that sounds good.
And we also have a talk of Dark Shadows.
Dark Shadows coming up on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Now, just before we go to something a little bit different. Okay, so Tara, I want to find out from you, what got you interested in films of this type? And can you say it in 30 seconds?
That might be a little bit difficult in 30 seconds. I'm not sure what it was that really got me interested. Perhaps it was the first time I ever saw Eraserhead. I didn't like the film. I didn't understand the film and was completely thrown by it. And I think something that really is jarring or abrasive in that manner that throws up things that you've never come across before leads you to want to find out more about it and why and what it is that you didn't like. And actually that turned into what is now my favourite cult film.
You and Thomas Caldwell, who I met on the train, are definitely in the same boat there.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, this is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
You got your good things, and I got mine.
Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. That is part of the trailer for Eraserhead, the 1977 surrealistic cult film, I would call it, Tara?
Yes, something like that, or perhaps even a surrealist nightmare, I think it often gets described as well. It's very much thought of as a suburban nightmare, all the things that are bubbling beneath the surface in suburban life and with the sort of familial relationships particularly. It's a disturbing but also very humorous film. It's actually, I think, a lot more lighthearted than it possibly comes across on first viewing. It's certainly abrasive. It's got one of the most difficult sound scores to listen to.
I made a mistake of buying the soundtrack thinking, I've seen the film, I saw it in a secondhand store, the soundtrack, and I took it home and played it, and it's just say the house cleared so quickly of people.
Yeah, it's not an easy soundtrack, but I think that's one of the things that is so great about the film. To be able to use, particularly with an element of film like that, sound in such a way that it communicates so much of what the film is about to its audience is a really remarkable craft from a filmmaker, and one of the things that set David Lynch apart very early on.
And how would you describe the plot? I mean, how could you describe the plot without giving it away? Because there's certain scenes in there that you don't want to give away because you don't want people not to go and see it.
No, I don't think you want to know anything about the plot before you go see this film. I think it's best if the less you know, probably the better, and approaching it, the best way to view it for the first time is to let it all wash over you and just go along, but not take it too seriously, and do realize that there are some really humorous
and he started making it 1971 or 72, I read, and it took him 6 years, and he was living in the set. He broke up with his first wife, and the baby went, you know, with the first wife, and it shows in the whole film construct.
I think there's a lot of personal connection in there somewhere, which is disturbing, but also, again, quite entertaining.
What I love about it too is with Lynch, you've got the same sort of actors being used again and again, recycled throughout either Twin Peaks or even as late as Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire, same people turning up.
Yeah, absolutely. Very much like his visual style, he reuses his actors as something that I think asserts him very much as well as an auteur. You know, I mean, those sort of recurring themes as well as the actors that he obviously likes to work with and feels that he gets the right performances out of are things that contribute to his work as an oeuvre, which is, you know, a real body of work, and you definitely get, as you go on throughout his films, progressively very much his worldview coming to the fore. And it's a very lighthearted worldview, but it's also very critical of the sort of dominant modes of ideology in society, I think. And that's one of the things that's great and transgressive about the film. Mm. And Eraserhead has certainly been one that has been misunderstood repeatedly throughout the years. I mean, it originally screened as one of the six original Midnight movies at the Elgin Theatre in New York City.
That's right.
And it had a great cult following then at the time, but it was very misunderstood, and it certainly critically took a long time to get quite as much acclaim as it has now. I think even now I often think the film is at least 100 years ahead of its time.
It is. Even when you look at it, you can't believe that 1977, the year of disco, mirrorballs and Star Wars. Even Star Wars is old fashioned when you look at this film.
Absolutely.
Seriously. The closest I think I can come to is The American Astronaut by Corey McAbee. That to me is cult, not quite B grade, but the style and the sensibility is very similar. It's totally abstract and surreal to me.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think David Lynch has always been doing something very different to what everyone else is doing. And it's certainly in 1977 when Eraserhead came out. And I think ever since, there's not really been a film quite like that challenges people in quite the same way. And I mean, I'm a huge David Lynch fan. But
you know,
it's very confronting. Repeat viewings help with this film. I think that don't see it the first time, think, wow, that was weird, and then just kind of let it pass into the ether. Stick with it, do it again and again and again, and every time you see it, it gets that little bit better.
All right, moving on to other cult films. Anything out there?
We got a message.
Oh, cool.
From Natty from Kensington. Her favourite cult film is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Right,
so
okay.
It's great to hear about other people's favourites.
Mitch.
Yes. Thank you for listening, Natty. but yeah, what's your favourite cult film, Sonia?
Well, I would have to say it would have to be some John Waters, I think. Female Trouble. more so than Pink Flamingos. Pink Flamingos is definitely out there, but that's what he was trying to do. And anybody who's probably been to Baltimore back in the 70s, if you've ever time traveled back there, probably good reason to rebel and make a film like Pink Flamingos where Divine eats dog shit.
Absolutely. I think that actually Female Trouble is one of my favorite John Waters films. And I'm glad you mentioned him, because I have a very, very soft spot for John Waters. He's one of my favorite directors. I don't have any of his films that I dislike, just an order in which I like them.
And Pecker? Actually, what about Pecker?
See, Peck is probably the one I like the least, but I'd still say it's a film that I enjoy.
It's about the penis all the way through it. It's like Pecker.
It's not my favourite John Waters film, but it's still got a good sense of humour to it. And I think with John Waters particularly, the sense of humour is just absolutely fantastic, particularly with Female Trouble, Desperate Living, those earlier films.
Desperate Living, the lesbian scene in Desperate Living. Whoa. Just look it up and okay, you know, maybe not have anything to eat beforehand. But this is purely my opinion. It is a B-grade cult film.
It is, absolutely. And his films were very instrumental, actually. John Waters is a fascinating case in terms of somebody who came from the underground, and Pink Flamingos was also an original Midnight movie, and then moved from the underground into a sort of mainstream type of filmmaking. And Polyester was the film that really broke for him in 1981 that came out and meant that he reached a slightly different audience. And since then, you know, he's gone on to become a lot more mainstream. And Hairspray, you know, is an incredible success. In the mainstream, which I always think is fascinating considering his films are predominantly anti-mainstream. So the fact that they've been assimilated into that culture is a really fascinating an example of the times and how things have been moving along. Certainly, we're a long way from Pink Flamingos now.
Is it something you'd give your mum for Mother's Day, Pink Flamingos?
No, and I dare say it's not the kind of movie you'd take someone onto a first date.
Oh, why
either.
Not? Why not?
It's interesting that you talk about someone being so critical of the mass media but being really rewarded for it by fans. The Beastie Boys, their most favourite song, famous song, Fight for Your Right to Party, was one that they refused to play later on at concerts because of its popularity. They were being quite critical, and we're playing a bit of a tribute song tonight because we've had some sad news.
One of them passed away.
Yeah, MCO passed away, so that's pretty sad, unfortunately.
I think it'd be really good to play a song tonight.
Intergalactic.
Not Fight for Your Right?
Not Fight for Your Right. It's not really a cult song, Intergalactic, but it's a good song.
And it's very relevant on Sci-Fi and Scream.
Yeah, because it's got robots in the video. If you get a chance to see it, we should put it on Facebook for people to look at and enjoy and break dance too.
Just before we pan, we got a text message from Sean in Port Melbourne, whose favourite cult film is Teeth.
My teeth are chattering at that one. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-Fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid on Joy 94.9.
As though this plan had been with him all his life, pondered through the seasons, now in his 15th year, crystallized with the pain of puberty.
So, why'd you move here?
My mom had to get a restraining order against my stepdad. He has emotional problems.
Oh, I have those too. What kind of emotional problems does your dad have?
I'm going to tell you a little story today about a young man whose life was completely destroyed by these instruments of fear.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination. Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what? I'm not going to be able to continue this conversation.
Don't worry. You got away with it.
We're just going to stop.
You should already know that.
It's Sci-Fi and Scream, Jim, but not as we know it.
It sure is. You're on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and we have received a text message from Shane, who has let us know that their favourite cult film is, well, there's two of them, Blue Velvet and Natural Born Killers. So thanks for listening, Shane.
And that song that we heard was the Tears for Fears song, but it was a cover, obviously, of their song Mad World from Donnie Darko by Gary Jules and Michael Andrews. Well, Michael Andrews played the piano and Gary sang along. And we won't say how sort of it kind of lowered the whole vibe in the studio here, but not in a bad way. Now, Donnie Darko came out in 2001 and it means it's 11 years old, according to my calculations.
Can you believe it? It's,
not really.
It's still so relevant.
Richard Kelly. But can you believe, is it cult? I'm just putting the question out there. I don't think it is. That's my opinion.
I think it's a difficult one. Richard Kelly is a curious fish.
Or rabbit?
I think that Donnie Darko is a fantastic film. I'm not very fond of the director's cut. And I think that
what the director's cut
really illustrates is that if somebody else edited Southland Tales, there might be a good movie in there. We just haven't seen it yet. But I don't know whether or not Donnie Darko necessarily would be a cult film. I think it definitely has a cult following. But I'm not necessarily sure that it's a little bit too mainstream, I think, to cut that label.
Yeah.
Is it mainstream because of the attention that it's received or because of, like, the production? I wonder if we could all see it again with no preempting how we'd feel about it. Because, you know, it follows that non-linear time narrative. I don't know. I think I'd have to say it's cult, in my humble opinion.
I was impressed when I first saw it, and it was like, wow, this is a, you know, breath of fresh air coming in. It seemed to get played a lot and everybody was talking about it. It was straight after American Beauty, so it had that same sort of sensibility of let's put some abstract stuff in there, let's put some dream sequences, and let's not quite make the narrative so straightforward. But it has some glaring obvious issues that I have with it, which is including the, if people haven't seen it, spoiler alert, the plane accident involving the mother and sister. And I just don't know about Frank and the old lady and so on and so on. There are things that, yeah, but I loved it when I first saw it.
Yeah,
anyone else?
I'm a big fan, but I don't know. It's a borderline one for cult, I think. I think you could go either way with your argument there.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, what we're going to do next, Emma,
is talk about Dark Shadows.
No. That's coming up. We're going to talk to Zoe.
Tell everyone what's going on. And then we're going to talk to Zoe.
I was pointing at you in the running sheet, so ignore me doing that. Yeah, Zoe Ma is here to talk about Ghosts in the Machine, or computers, actually. So that's going to be something that is it on now? Is it on now by any chance?
No, it's happening in the last week of May. It's part of the 2012 Next Wave Festival.
Okay.
So it opens on the, my show opens on the 22nd and runs until the 27th. The whole festival opens on the 19th.
And what is Next Wave for people that don't know?
Next Wave is a biennial festival for emerging artists from around Australia and some international artists as well. And it's got a focus on interdisciplinary and hybrid art forms. So things like performance art. There's a lot of dance happening, audio art. Yeah, really exciting.
You're
stuff.
In the audio art side.
I'm in the audio
right?
and performance art, yes.
That's
it's very hybrid. It's very contemporary.
Oh, okay. Cool. Now, is it the second year now for Next Wave?
It's been running for about 20 years now, so
goodness.
It's quite an old festival. Yeah,
wow.
Really been
shows
going
what
on
I know.
For a while.
Oops.
No, it's all such fresh stuff that it feels like a new festival every time it happens.
So why the interest? Was it your idea and concept as far as looking at CERAC? What does CERAC stand for, the old computer?
It's spelled CSIRAC.
Mm-hmm.
It stands for the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Automated Computer.
Boy, don't ask me to say
it's a
that.
Mouthful. Yep. It's like the CSIRO who built it, except with ACK on the end instead of O. And yeah, the idea came about. Look, full disclosure, I'm a huge nerd. I really love obsolete technologies.
Cool.
And I got really interested in CERAC just as a computer.
Right.
And
was it the look of it? Was it the aesthetic?
The look of it.
This is a whole room of machinery. It's really exciting.
Exactly. It's this massive computer.
How big is it? Like, what is the, comparatively speaking, how could
I'm awful with distances and dimensions. Yeah. I'd say it's about maybe 6 metres long and maybe 2 or 3 metres deep.
Wow. Okay.
It's huge. It looks like a massive filing cabinet. And yeah, so I was looking into this computer and I found an interview with Kay Thorne, and she was a technical assistant who worked with CSIRAC. It was operational throughout the 1950s into the very early 1960s in Melbourne.
Right.
And she spoke a little bit about human computers who came before mechanical computers like CSIRAC. And these were skilled workers who were usually female a lot of the time, who did very, very complex calculations. And I thought that was a really interesting story that I hadn't heard about. And when I spoke to other people about that, not many other people had heard about these women. So, yeah, I wanted to explore that a little bit and think about not only human computers that have been forgotten about, but mechanical computers like CSIRAC that maybe have been lost from public consciousness.
And I believe CSIRAC's one of two existing now of its type left in the world, which is amazing considering how many computers do we have now, how many PCs are in everybody's homes, and now with our telephones, you know, just shows you that 50-something years ago, we had lots of those sort of computers you're describing, but now we have two left in the whole entire world. That's it makes incredible. You feel really tiny, like an ant that That's someone could step on at any moment.
Yeah.
Now, before that happens, we've got some audio that you've kindly let us play this evening. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear?
Yeah, this is a section from the show. The show, it works as an audio tour, so small groups of people do it all together, and then at certain points it's interrupted by the ghost of computers past, who takes over the audio tour and appears in certain spots. And this section that we're about to hear is the ghost interrupting the tour in the area, the part of the museum where the dinosaur skeletons are. So anyone who's visited the museum, it's a really big hall full of dinosaur skeletons.
And so really this computer is a dinosaur.
Exactly, and that comparison is certainly made in the tour. It's an angry dinosaur computer ghost.
So this starts May the 22nd, your particular piece that we're talking about.
That's right. Opens on the 22nd.
At Melbourne Museum. Cool. We'll have to put some stuff on Facebook about that so people can look that up. So let's have a listen to that.
And
thanks,
certainly through the Next Wave website as well, tickets.
Oh, what's
bookings
that?
Bookings are open now.
What's that website
address? It's nextwave.org.au, and you can follow the program links through to Goodbye CSIRAC.
Cool. Thank you. This is Sci-Fi and Scream.
Synapses firing. CSIRAC was full of electricity too. All computers, and we do mean all computers, machine or otherwise, share four traits. Input, output, decisions, memory. Input, the means of receiving data from the outside world. Processor, enabling it to make decisions about this data. An output, to communicate its results back into the world. And a memory. With newer models comes ever-increasing efficiency and obsolescence waiting in the wings. Those dinosaurs, some flying overhead, some stretching up towards the mezzanine, all so long gone. They too became obsolete. They too were replaced. Now they are fawned upon, adored by children, revered. There was a time when we didn't even know they had existed. Waited, cold and underground, waited for somebody, anybody, to pick up one little stone tooth and remember them.
Ah!
Earth.
Fire.
Wind.
Water.
Heart.
Sci-fi and scream.
Sci-fi and scream.
On Joy 94.9.
My name is Barnabas Collins. 2 centuries ago, I made Collinwood my home.
My love.
Until a jealous witch cursed me, condemning me to the shadows.
What have you done?
For all time.
What the hell is this?
He's coming. He's coming.
Hear me, future dweller. What is the year?
1972.
1972. My beloved Collinwood.
The Collins family.
Who the hell is this?
I'm a vampire, madam.
Yeah.
He's not staying with us forever, is he?
I like him.
Oh, super fat.
Welcome home, Barnabas Collins.
How soon can the horses be ready?
We don't have horses. We have a Chevy.
What sorcery is this?
Reveal yourself, tiny songstress.
Hello, Barnabas.
Remember me?
Witch, you cursed me to be this hideous creature.
You may strategically place your wonderful lips upon my posterior and kiss it repeatedly.
What if I made you love me?
With what a spell?
With this.
I must admit, they have not aged a day.
She for real?
Indeed.
If I can't have you, I'll destroy you. And your family.
Missed me. I shall restore the family business to its former glory.
Burn, baby. Burn.
Fight on, Barnabas. Fight on for us.
And fight I shall. Never. That was a regrettable turn of events.
Are you stoned or something?
They tried stoning me, my dear. It did not work.
Sci-fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Barry White, You're My One and My Everything. Now, that's from the trailer of Dark Shadows, which we were very... luckily, we were able to see this evening here on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. So, Emma, was there?
I was there. I still haven't formed an opinion. I'm so up in the air.
Okay.
I think that I liked it, but I was quite disappointed with a few aspects of it. One of them being a sort of Tim Burton pandering to the audience that I don't really respect at all. An example of that was one of the sort of cheap laughs on the ad. You know, they tried stoning me, my dear. It didn't work.
Yeah.
We're better than that. You're better than that, Tim. That's what I think. But it was good. What did you think?
I really enjoyed this film. I think overall as an experience, I found it a very enjoyable cinema-going experience. I certainly had issues with some things in the film. Largely, they were to do with the CGI. I think that Tim Burton has a fantastic eye for visual style, and I think that Colleen Atwood's costumes are incredible, and I think the sets, the design, the makeup, all of those things were very intricate and really successful, and so the CGI just was an element that wasn't needed. It was that one step too far sometimes towards the end of the film, which I thought was a little bit disappointing, and we saw some of that in his Alice in Wonderland as well. So that was one thing that I thought let it down a little bit. The other thing for me was the role of the women in this film who don't really have very much agency and who are either sort of evil or wicked or come from a kind of deceptive place or are somehow instrumental in his demise. And they're not very strong characters, and that always upsets me in film. I don't like to see the female characters being the weaker ones or the ones that are always villainized and made to be responsible for the negativity.
I wanted to see more Michelle Pfeiffer. I felt that her character, thinking about it, her character is a sort of the matriarch of the Collins family, where just briefly what the plot is about. It's about, spoiler alert, if you haven't heard or know about Dark Shadows, it's about a vampire that comes well, he comes back to his estate, I suppose you call it, his family home, 200 years a bit too late. So he arrives back into 1972, where the film is set, the film that we saw this evening. But with Michelle Pfeiffer there as that matriarch, she didn't feel very in control or powerful enough. And I was disappointed because I really thought she's got the acting chops to deliver, and didn't get a chance to.
She didn't. I think that it was a shame that the moment that she's sort of basically in charge of the house, like you said, prior to Barnabas's return, and then as soon as he steps back into the role, it very much reverts to being a patriarchal society, and the law and order is very much descending from him.
Yeah.
I'd also like to call attention to the glaring plot holes and some things thrown into the mix very late in the show. I don't want to spoil too much, but Sonia, I know that you know there's a reason for some of the...
We think there's a reason through our analysis and our detective work and a bit of, not CGI, but CSI. We've decided forensically that something to do with something called a writer's strike in 2007, when I think this film was certainly being put together and pre-production mode, and particularly with the screenplay, they had various screenwriters come on, and I think it shows that there seems to be a jump around of the plot and even the style and mood. And Tara, you were saying that you felt there was something going on there.
Yeah, I think the tone and the pace definitely changes throughout the film. It's very quick-witted at the beginning. You get a lot of pacey jokes, and they tend to be a little bit more stilted towards the latter parts of the film. And certainly, like you pointed out, Emma, there's certainly those moments later on where the jokes are perhaps not of the same sophistication as they were earlier in the film. I think that definitely it does change in pace and tone. Not aesthetically. I think it's aesthetically even throughout the film, but obviously that's to do with the making. So the writer's strike would make some sense.
Well, they went through two writers. I'm just looking here. John August was the original screenplay writer for Dark Shadows. But then in 2010, screenwriter Seth Graham Smith jumped in and took over. And it was filmed, actually, interestingly enough, entirely in England at Pinewood Studios, which of course is famous for the James Bond franchise from the 60s. So it had that stagey sort of feeling that we get from Burton films anyway. And I must admit, I love the beginning shot. It reminded me a little bit of The Shining at the beginning when they're going to Maine through all the beautiful autumn trees and everything. And on closer examination, as I leaned forward over my popcorn, I think those were train models. I don't think they were real at all. So I don't think that was CGI either.
You've just spoiled the illusion for me. No.
Sorry. I was looking closely and going, that's an old Amtrak. They don't have those models anymore. I think that's a model. I just think I saw a little human here floating on the lake there. Trust me to notice that.
And so now, before we go to a little break, we're going to listen to some music from Rocky Horror, a really good cult film that we haven't really had a chance to touch base on.
What do we think, Dark Shadows? What are we going to give it, though, before we finish with that business, before we stake it in the heart?
In terms of aesthetic and mise-en-scene, sort of probably I'd give it a solid... Wait, are we going out of five or are we going out of ten?
Yeah, let's go out of five.
I think I'd give it a three, but plot and my mood afterwards, I'd have 2.5.
I'm about the same.
I'm not very good with star ratings, but I'm just going to go with 3 because I think that's a little bit indecisive, which is how I'm feeling.
It's a lucky number, isn't it? Number 3. All right, this is Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
In space, no one can hear you scream. On Joy 94.9, it's a different story. Sci-Fi and Squeam, Thursday nights, 11 to 1. Enjoy 94.9.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia, Mitch and Emma.
Hello. Now, we had a lovely message from Bryony, and her favourite cult film is, well, there's a couple here, Performance, Donald Camel and Nicholas Rogue. I think I said that right, Rogue. And City Girl by Martha Coolidge. Thanks for that, Bryony. Cool. Thanks for your messages, guys, tonight. Emma.
I'd like to jump ship and say that Rocky Horror Picture Show is my favourite cult film. I'm sorry, Frankenhooker, but I just forgot.
Well, there's a similarity there. Frankenfurter, Frankenhooker, it's something to do with eating. And that piece of music was... What was that one?
That was There's a Light.
No, over at Frankenstein's Place. And yes. That was from the original Broadway show.
The original cast with Tim Curry.
The original cast with Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Version. So, yeah.
We were going all gothic in the studio here, almost.
Actually, I think it was more like Jazz Hands. Oh.
That's my favourite Rocky Horror song. That's
what, Jazz Hands? I don't know that
Jazz
one.
Jazz Hands. No. Over at the Frankenstein's Place.
Palace Place.
I like science fiction double feature.
Yeah,
and I know Tara has an opinion as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it has to be Sweet Transvestite for me. There's something about Tim Curry in a corset and heels and that just is so wrong and
the
so right.
It's, fishnets.
And those fish. It is. It's just so right.
Zoe, do you have a favourite from the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Look, I can't go past Sweet Transvestite.
Yeah.
And have you guys seen Tim Curry in the old Worst Witch movie? It's
no.
Definitely worth a YouTube if you like him singing Sweet Transvestite. Oh, comedy gold.
Oh, right.
You know you've got great guests when no one picked the time warp.
There's a moment for the time warp.
There's always a moment for the time warp.
So we've been looking at cult films, and there's just too many to mention, actually. Repo Man was one of them, but we're running out of time for that. We've only got a minute left. So in that minute, what do we want to say? Tara, you have something to say about the Aster, no doubt.
Yeah, I guess the last thing I should probably say is that a lot of those cult films that we talked about regularly show at the Astor Theatre. So we do show Eraserhead very often. We have Rocky Horror Picture Show on every single calendar and people get dressed up. And we encourage you to get dressed up, sing along, dance along, throw rice and just get involved. It's a really, really fun evening. We do actually have a David Lynch season coming up at the end of July. So check that out because there's going to be a few of those great films we talked about, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway all in there. And you can find out more details from the website, which is astortheatre.net.au.
Cool. Thank you so much, guys, for coming in. I really want to thank everyone for being here. Thank you for anyone
who's listening. Thank you, Zoe, Tara, Emma, Mitch and Sonia for being here.
And
next week, it's Scream Queens number 3.
Scream Queens the 3rd.
So we will have guests. We'll have Kirsten McDermott in here, author of some YA vampire supernatural stuff, and Frank Condolero.
Are you prepared for the zombie apocalypse? In case of emergency, break glass and tune in to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.